Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies. I am Anna Obererlacher, the host of this episode. Today, we will be talking to Frances Courtney Kneuper about her new book, The Empire at the End of Time, Identity and Reform in Late Medieval German Prophecy. Frances Courtney Kneuper currently holds a position as an associate professor of medieval history at the University of Mississippi. Frances Kneuper, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Frances, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. So let's see where to begin. I was born in Texas, and I attended Rice University for my undergraduate degree. I have a degree there in, not in history, actually, in art history. But then I went on to graduate studies in history at Northwestern University in Evanston, which is outside of Chicago. And it is there that I really became interested in questions about descent in particular, and ways that people have tried to object to the status quo or to defy sort of the current authority of the time, and especially religious dissent. So I did a lot of work on things like heresy in the late Middle Ages, and then I turned from that to prophecy, which is what The Empire at the End of Time is about. I came first to the University of Mississippi, actually, while I was still working on my doctorate. So I began teaching here in 2010, I believe, and then taught here for several years as a visiting professor, and then as an assistant professor, and now as an associate professor.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, very interesting. Frances, the title of your book, The Empire and the End of Time, could be straight from a TV show or, let's say, a Hollywood film. And indeed, you are writing about stories, a very specific kind of stories, prophecies. Specifically, you examine apocalyptic prophecies in the late medieval Holy Roman Empire. How did you come to write The Empire and the End of Time?
Oh yeah, I love that you said it could be like a film today. I think that's great because when I try to explain to people about prophecies, I often refer to films today. So what I mean by that is, you know, kind of the first thing to know is that prophecies in the Middle Ages, they weren't just these kind of odd, obscure, you know, like bizarre outlying texts. But instead they were something much more mainstream, and they were very popular, and they were about visions of the future. And what I explain to people is that medieval people were worried about the future. They feared uncertainty, and they also had an expectation that the world would be ending soon, but before the world ended, there would be a calamitous time, a time of upheaval and violence, and so they created these visions as ways to kind of imagine what could be, and the reason I say this is like films today is we have these same fears, we have these same ideas about the future or the unknown, what will it hold, and we create our own visions. So today they're more likely to be dystopian novels, for example, or dystopian films, but they express these same kind of themes of there will be some calamitous times, there will be some terrible upheaval that the world will have to go through, and you know, what might that look like? And so people read prophecies in the past for a lot of the same reasons that we go to dystopian films today. But let's see. So really you're asking me about how did I get into this topic, right?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it came through the idea of descent, and that I'm always interested in ways that people objected to current authorities and tried to kind of overthrow the norm. And it started, as I said, with heresy. So I was looking at different religious groups in the late Middle Ages and the ways that they expressed ideas that went against the current thinking of the church or the current teachings of the church. And one of the groups that I looked at had a kind of prophetic aspect. And so they combined kind of rejecting church teachings with making these very dramatic predictions about the future. And I thought, now this is interesting stuff. And so I dug more and I found, like I said, that there were all of these visions of the future, these visions of the end times that were written and circulating in the late Middle Ages. They were very popular. And many of them, no scholars had ever really read or looked at it all.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as I understand, you visited a lot of libraries in the German-speaking areas in Europe. What was the material you were working with for this book? And what is it your book can shine a new light on?
So maybe the first thing to know is that what a prophecy looks like, or what a medieval prophecy looks like, and you were right when you said they look like stories, but they're sort of little stories. They're usually maybe only a couple of pages long, kind of predictions about a sort of list of events that will take place. And as such, they were short enough that they were probably shared orally. So people just talking to each other, you know, hey, Anna, have you heard about this prophecy that before the world ends, there will be a great flood, or, you know, this kind of thing. But then they also began to be written down and copied. And they were copied in all kinds of places. But where I was looking for them is in manuscripts. Not because that's the only place that they probably existed, but it's sort of the only place where they still remain. So in sort of large manuscripts copied in both German and Latin in the 14th and 15th century, you can find many, many copies of prophecies written by different people. One of the most striking discoveries for me was that these prophecies were being shared to a large degree among lay people. So meaning people who were not a part of the church, who were outside of clerical authority. And this was something that was quite new, because for one, lay people actually weren't really reading and writing very much before the 14th century. So kind of with the rise of literacy, vernacular literacy, there also was a rise in the writing of copy of prophecies and the copying of prophecies and the sharing of them among us. So it's just really a new group of people. Before this, we would find knowledge about the end times and people writing about the end times, but they would all be writing in Latin and they would all be male clerics. And that was sort of, it was considered a part of Christian teaching. And because they had access to this Christian teaching, that was kind of an acceptable thing for them to write about. Well, suddenly in the 14th and especially the 15th century, we find all sorts of people writing and reading about the end times and what's going to happen before the end times. We find a beer brewer, for example, who's writing down prophecies. He didn't invent them himself, but he's got copies of them and he's copying them into books. And then we have other, the more ordinary level of literate person is accessing these prophecies.
Well, it's very interesting, and I'm sure that's nothing you would usually expect. Well, let's have a look right into your book. What How would you describe, and I think you said some of the things right now, how would you describe the conditions and practices of text production and perception in that time with regards to the writing people, institutions, language, and contexts?
Yes. Well, so the late Middle Ages, in general, it was a time of increased vernacular literacy. So, I mean, we could call it an explosion, really, where people were very interested in reading and writing. And so, I mean, people outside the church became interested in reading and writing. And so there was an enormous rise in the amount of literature that was produced that could be read that wasn't in Latin. And many more different kinds of people were reading and writing. Middling level people, especially in towns, townspeople were interested in reading and also in having their own copies of books. I mean, of course, in the end, this is going to lead to the invention of the printing press, right? There's a great demand among many different kinds of people for reading material, and so Gutenberg is going to meet that demand by coming up with a way to produce more books and to produce them more cheaply. So prophecy, it makes sense that prophecies would become something that were absorbed by lay people at this time, because they're excited and interested in absorbing lots of different kinds of things. One of the things that I found that was quite interesting was the use of German as opposed to Latin. And we already kind of touched on that, but this is it's a big deal. It's a big surprise because there was, until this time, there was an expectation that literature regarding religion, and especially regarding anything that you might think of as kind of sensitive to do with religion, that should be written in Latin. That was really the prerogative of clerics, of male clerics. And that if anything was going to be written and disseminated in the vernacular, it needed to be kind of more basic, right? What clerics would call the simple people, the simple lay people, they couldn't read, you know, complex theology or sort of these more complicated ideas. They were given simple texts, simple pious texts that they couldn't possibly misinterpret. Well, prophecies are not simple pious texts. They're in fact quite dramatic, and they often contain criticism of the church, or almost always the ones I looked at contain criticism of the current church. So for those to be translated into German and written in German and shared among the ordinary lay people is a very dramatic event.
Your book is divided into three main parts. The first part we just talked about, that's the context. And in the second part, you take a look into individual prophecies of these late medieval German-speaking Europe. And can you give us an overview? What interested you in these prophecies in general before we take a deeper look into each one of these prophecies?
Well, I mean, first of all, I could not deny readers the chance to hear some of these descriptions and the stories that come out in these prophecies, because they're really delightful and they're very fascinating. So they're quite creative texts. They're very imaginative, and they're places where it seems that late medieval people could really kind of let their imaginations run free. So they're very visual, and they contain, you know, as I said, they have usually like a very sinister kind of violent element to them, but they also contain beautiful imagery. Some of my favorite examples, there's a prophecy it's actually originally by Hildegard of Bingen, who was a 12th century abbess, but it was quite popular in the late Middle Ages. And it's a description of the church, imagined as a beautiful woman who is as tall as the sky. And she's wearing this beautiful dress. But then if you look more closely, part of the dress is blackened. And then if you look closely, it's ripped, and her shoes are muddied. And so, you know, then she kind of goes on to explain, you know, that this is the state of the corruption of the church and corruption of current society. But it's this beautiful visual that you get. And many of the prophecies have this. They have mermaids in them. They have the doors of St. Mark's kind of floating into the sky. They have imaginary creatures that are half eagle and half man. And so part of it is just the fun of really digging into these rich images.
Well, I could go on forever to listen to what you're talking about. It's really so contemporary also,
I think,
the pictures. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's something about it that is kind of timeless.
Mm-hmm. Well, you start this part of the analysis of the prophecies with the Gamaliel prophecy. You mentioned that for centuries, the Gamaliel prophecy has created a puzzle for scholars. Why is that, and what makes this prophecy so special?
Well, I think one thing to say kind of about prophecy in general is that, you know, I said before, they're often short, and so they could be copied into a manuscript, and you find them sometimes. A scribe is just copying some other text, and he's got, I say he because they were really almost all he's in the manuscripts that I found. But so he's got like a little space at the end of the page. So he just copies in a prophecy here, you know, kind of slips one in here and there. They are untitled, and they are anonymous for the most part. So even trying to sort of figure out to find them and then to identify a text is very difficult, because another thing that medieval people seem to have liked to do with prophecies is to change them to suit their needs. So they, you know, you kind of picture how this works. I'm a scribe, and I come across this prophecy, and it's you know, it's predicting that these things are going to happen. The clergy is going to be attacked, and there's going to be a new church. And there's going to be an earthquake in, let's say, 1415. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading this, and it's 1416. And there hasn't been an earthquake. So I say, you know, I read this prophecy, and it really seems true. I think there's a lot of things about it that really strike me as true, but they clearly got the date wrong for the earthquake. So I'm just going to change that. I think what they really meant was, I don't know, 1417. Or maybe I'm going to add this thing to it. You know, I'm going to say, and a new emperor will be elected, because I think that's a part of it. So there's a sense that prophecies were sort of texts that you could take apart, and you could use the parts that you wanted. You could add in different sections and kind of make Frankenstein prophecies out of them. And I really think when people did this, that they thought that they were only bringing it closer to the truth by doing that. You understand? They didn't. I don't think they did it cynically. But this is something that certainly that happened with the Gamaliel prophecy. And so what it means is then you read a prophecy, and you find different versions. And sometimes prophecies are put together and to try to take them apart and figure out what is the kind of the original, if we even want to say that, can be quite a mystery and can be quite a challenge. And that's something that happened with the Gamaliel prophecy and also several of the others.
Well, and prophecies can have a significant influence on the development of a city, an area, and an identity, as you point out also later in the book. The second prophecy you analyze is the so-called letter of Brother Siegwald. Can you tell us a bit about the text and its significance to the history of the German city of Nuremberg and for an understanding of prophecy and German identity in the Middle Age?
Yes, absolutely. This is, I think this is such an interesting prophecy. So this is a prophecy that's sort of written as a letter, and the premise of it is that a holy hermit named Brother Siegwald was commanded by God to write a prophetic letter and to hide this letter away for future times. And then he was supposed to hide three keys at significant locations. And so it was only when these keys were found that the moment would sort of be ripe and the letter would reappear and it would inform its readers about future events. And one of the most important events was that Nuremberg itself would become a righteous city. Basically, it would become the new Rome. So there's this, I mean, partially it's almost like a treasure map story. So it's this kind of, you know, it's hidden and it will only be rediscovered at the right time. And you've got to find the keys, and the keys are supposed to be hidden in locations that were significant to the history of Nuremberg. But you can imagine if you were a proud citizen of Nuremberg in the 15th century, this idea that Nurembergers that Nuremberg itself would become the new Rome, and that Nurembergers would become kind of the righteous new Romans. Well, that would have quite a ring, and it was especially significant because of the history of the city of Nuremberg itself, which had strong ties to the Holy Roman Emperor, and one of the things I write about in this chapter is that the imperial regalia, for example, had been translated from the city of Prague to the city of Nuremberg, and this was considered very significant for Nurembergers. They thought that this was a kind of legitimizing of the city of Nuremberg and its importance as an imperial center and an imperial heart. And this was once a year, the insignia was all displayed and the regalia, and it was considered holy as well. And there would be a procession. There was also a market associated with it. So that there was an economic kind of uplift as well that took place. But it was very important to Nuremberg citizens to think of themselves as the heart of the empire and as having this kind of special identity as kind of the true Germans, we could say, or really the true Romans, because there was an idea that that the Roman Empire had been translated to the Germans, and that the Germans were now going to be the true Romans because they were righteous and worthy of that role.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, very important for this period of time, because Germany didn't have a real center, right? Like Rome or other countries like Paris or London. Germany wasn't quite as structured in that way politically and also in terms of language, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the points of my book, or kind of one of the important things that I learned from the prophecies, is this issue of German identity. And that very much there was a a feeling in the late Middle Ages, where a lot of scholars would argue there was no such thing as a German identity. That if you were to ask someone, what are you? They wouldn't say I'm a German. You know, maybe they would say, well, I'm a Nuremberger, or I'm an Augsburger. This was really something that was developing an idea of, well, what am I, and what does it mean to be German? And I found that prophecies were a place where this question could be expressed.
Mm-hmm. And some of the prophecies, as you pointed out earlier, were really popular at the time. Also, the prophecy you write in your book, the third example you give, the Auffahrtabend prophecy. What is this prophecy about, and what made it so popular?
Ah, yes, the Auffahrtabend prophecy. Yes, this one was incredibly popular. I'm trying to remember. We have, I think, 25 examples that are extant, and since we could say, that's probably only a quarter of what actually existed at the time. I mean, we're talking about something like 100 copies, or probably even more than that. The Auffahrtabend prophecy, it makes a very strong statement about the church. And when I say the church, I mean the hierarchical church with its head as the papacy in Rome. And it's very important to distinguish between that, the church as an institution, and kind of Christianity more generally. So the Auffahrtabend prophecy is highly critical of the church as an institution. And it's quite vicious, actually, in what it predicts for clerics. And I was going to look to see if I could read you a quote. I'm not sure that I could find one that quickly. But it predicts predicts the downfall of the church. It predicts that clerics who are too prideful will be cast down and broken. But then what's important here is, as well, is that this will be done by Germans. That the Germans have a special role in this overthrow of the church, and that in place of the institution that exists now, the Germans will create their own church. They will have a new free church that is German. Mm-hmm. And that is, this is quite shocking for the time, because of course there was only supposed to be one church. I mean, now we kind of think, there are many different churches and many ways to be Christian, but no, there was supposed to be one church, and there was supposed to be one obedience. And for German speakers to be able to fantasize in this way about casting off that Roman church and creating their own, this is very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. Well, you would expect that from a later period of time, maybe with the 18th century, the Enlightenment, the critic on the church and the clerics, but in this period of time, it's really astonishing.
Yes, no, I think so, and I think I think that prophecies were a special place where people felt that they could, because it's in the subjunctive, right? It's not. They're not saying it's happening now. They're not even necessarily saying it should happen, but they can kind of play out these very violent scenarios and possibly express, their kind of secret political wishes or their secret collective wishes in a way that they might not be able to do in a more straightforward manner.
Mm-hmm. So put the ideas into a story, a kind of a fictional story, but yeah.
Yes, yes, exactly. But a very special kind of fictional mm-hmm. story, right? Because in theory, these predictions are visions from God, and mm-hmm. and therefore they are in some way they're righteous and they're inevitable. So you could kind of you could fantasize and put it into the story, and at the same time you have this this extraordinary legitimacy that you can claim for them.
You mentioned that the letter of Brother Siegwald were in form of letters, and also the last chapter of this part of the book, you close with the Wirsberger letters. What's the significance of these letters?
Oh, yes. So the Wirsberger letters, they're a little bit different from the others. In several ways, they're a little bit less stories. They have kind of less of the beautiful visuals. But the most interesting difference, the most exciting difference, is that they were actually written by laymen and laymen that we can pinpoint who they were historically. So it's very rare for expressions of dissent, and they're highly critical of the church. They're extremely critical and violent. It is very rare for lay people to be able to write those kind of commentaries about the church and to have them survive. Now, I'm certain that other lay people did write kind of vitriolic texts regarding the church, but usually those don't survive. They are condemned and they're destroyed. So to be able to find these letters written by two brothers, there were two brothers who disseminated them at any rate, Levin and Johannes. And Johannes, we believe, is probably the one who actually wrote the letters, but they wrote these letters predicting terrible events that would occur before the end of the world. In these events, especially they condemned the clergy and they predicted violent deaths for clergy members. They also predicted that the German Empire would have a kind of special role in the reform of the church. But they wrote these out in the vernacular and they sent them to authorities all across the German Empire. So they sent them, for example, to the city Council of Nuremberg, the Rat of Nuremberg. They sent them to the head of the Franciscan Order in Germany. They sent them to the heads of the universities and to other city councils and to princes. So they thought, you know, here we have this message about the future. It's incredibly important. This is coming soon, and we've got to share it with everyone who's significant in the German Empire so that Germans can be prepared.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting what you say about the distribution of these prophecies, because it seemed to be, easier to distribute these letters than to copy a book and give that or send that to another place. Is that also a reason why these prophecies became so popular? Because they were, it was significantly easier to distribute them.
Yes, I think that's probably true. Yes, so I suspect that oftentimes they were, you know, they were copied on a sheet or two of paper and then they were shared with somebody else and they could be shared easily that way. We don't have examples of that anymore. I can only think of one time where there's a manuscript where this is actually a mentor of mine. He opened the manuscript and a single sheet of paper fell out with a prophecy written on it. And, you know, but it's a clue, right, that people were writing these down on a single sheet of paper or front and back, and they were able to easily share those and to pass them around. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Just imagine how many things like that, though, there probably were that have been lost to us. If someone didn't kind of get struck by it and say, oh, I'm going to write this into a manuscript, it's gone.
Mm. Well, it's astonishing. I'm really excited about this project, really. what also interested me was in your analysis, you always follow the tracks of authorship. And today we are used that books have authors, but in the Middle Age, the concept of authorship was a completely different one. Can you tell us a bit about that and maybe about the authors of these prophecies and how the texts have been written by these authors?
Yes. Well, so, I mean, you're absolutely right. We have this idea of like an original text that's written by one author, right? And so, you know, you say, well, what's the original and who was the author? And people in the Middle Ages, they didn't really view texts that way in general. They had much more kind of fluid relationship with texts, I would say, where they weren't concerned necessarily about authenticity in the way that people in modern times would be, and so what that means, and then I think with prophecies even more so. So what that means for prophecies is on the one hand, they were really treated as tools, and so tools to take and to use as they could be used, which means, you know, in some cases they could be manipulated, but it also means they could kind of, they were fluid. They could be shared, they could be added to, they could be subtracted from. They didn't have some authentic original form that you could ever get back to. And it's trying too hard to do it is a big challenge. And they also, this was a genre that was intentionally anonymous. Most of the authors kind of obscured their writing or their authorship. It's very rare. I mean, in the case of the Weersbrugger brothers, yes, we actually know who wrote them. And it's amazing because in most cases, we don't know who the author was. It was more likely if they wanted an author, they would just pick someone who had some authority and they would attribute the prophecy to that person. One example is the Auffahrt Abend prophecy was attributed to a theologian, Heinrich von Langenstein, because there are plausible reasons why he might have written such a thing, and because he was a clerical authority. So, you know, good name to attach to a prophecy, but of course he wasn't the actual author. Hildegard of Bingen, I mentioned before, but she was a very well-respected prophetess of an earlier age. She was also a German. And so if I came across a good prophecy, I could attach it to her name, and that would give it kind of some clout that it might not otherwise have. But yeah, very much these are things that were that they traveled on their own without having roots in the same way that we think of texts having, which is, it's an incredible challenge for a historian, but it's also extremely fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine that. Well, in part three of your book, you concentrate on the themes in late medieval German prophecy, especially the context of the church and the clergy, is therefore of vast importance. How are these prophecies connected with these institutions? How are you illustrating in your book the dynamics between the church, the clergy, and the prophetic thought?
So I alluded to this a bit, but virtually every single one of the prophecies that I encountered contains predictions regarding the overthrow of the current church. They're criticisms of the the church structure and especially of the behavior of the Roman clergy. So, for example, one prophecy accuses bishops of arrogance and gluttony and lewdness. They often accuse clergy members of hypocrisy. So there's a sense that they disapprove of the lifestyle of especially the higher clergy, and that they're not doing their jobs correctly, right? They're supposed to be behaving like the apostles, and they're supposed to be living lives of piety and chastity and poverty. And according to these prophecies, instead, what they're doing is living like very wealthy princes, and they're not chaste, and they're eating these vast meals, and they're drinking tons of wine, and they've got huge palaces, and they've got stables full of horses, and you know, all of this kind of stuff. And then the prediction is, well, they will be overthrown. Some will be murdered in their beds. Some will be burned. They're quite violent. They're really sinister. There will be bloodshed. Their horses will be taken away, and instead they'll be given hobby horses. Their jewels will be taken away. Their gold will be taken, and they'll be given lead. So there's all of this kind of the clergy will get what is coming to them from the perspective of the prophecies. So what I argue is that really prophecies became a place where people could have these kind of conversations, where they could express these kind of critiques of the church. Now, it's important, again, as I say, it's not a critique of Christianity. It's not a critique of pious Orthodox belief or of practices. It's not a critique of things that we'll see later in Martin Luther, like indulgences or prayers for the dead. No, it's a critique of the current hierarchy and the current authority, and there's an idea that it will all be taken down in these cataclysms of the end times.
Yeah, and the second part the second part of the third part of your book is again about the German identity, and you pointed that out before. Would you like to summarize that idea and what you found out in your research about these connections between these prophecies and the German identity? German identity that wasn't a fixed idea yet in that time, or at least we thought it wasn't.
Yes, right. Well, so I mean, I should say this is something that I wasn't expecting when I began researching prophecies. I would read, you find them, and I would read them, and I thought, that's remarkable. It's in German. Look, this one's in German as well. And I started to count, and I thought, well, more of them are written in German than in Latin. What could that tell me? And so the first thing I thought is, well, obviously it means that Germans are reading them. They must be intended for Germans. They're the only ones who could actually be reading these texts. Well, now, so what could that tell me? And I started to think about this idea, if something's written in Latin, that it's for an international audience, right? That it's speaking to all Christians, or at least all Christians who are literate and can read it. But if something is written in German, then it's exclusive in a way. It's meant for a certain group. And then I looked at the content, of course, of the prophecies, and they talk about we the Germans, and we the people of the German Empire. And then this comes up often as a theme. And that very much surprised me, because it really is the kind of historical convention is that there was no such thing as German in the late Middle Ages, that this was not a self-conscious identity that existed. And I thought, well, wait a second. somebody, if they're writing, you know, we the Germans, and they're writing in German, and they're really giving Germans a special role in these prophecies, usually as kind of chastisers and reformers, then I think we're looking at a place where a German identity is being built. So that somebody must have been asking themselves, you know, what does it mean to be German? What is a German? And that this was one of the ways that they were answering that question, is by thinking about kind of in this imaginary place, in these visions, what Germans might contribute to the future. Mm-hmm. And so as I started to map that out, I found, yeah, it very much carries out through the prophecies, that many of these prophecies make some reference to Germans or the Germans, or even just by being in the German language, they're at least indicating that there's a special group that they might be intended for.
How challenging was it for you to translate these texts into present times, not only in terms of language, but also in terms of their exegesis? What are the challenges or maybe advantages of working with these texts?
No, I think that they're very challenging. I mean, I will say on the one hand, they're fairly simply written. So I think this is because they're meant for kind of an ordinary level of education, you know, so somebody in the 15th century who could read could pick up one of these texts and read and understand it. So, you know, unlike trying to read some complicated theological tract, it's rather straightforward in the language, but of course, the translation was really challenging. I mean, we're talking about a form of German. It's not really Middle High German, and it's not really Early Modern German. It's kind of somewhere in between those two, and so I would have to look a lot of places to refer when I couldn't understand what a word was referring to. I would have to look a lot of places. So that part in itself was a challenge, and certainly trying to. I think there are a lot of levels of translation. So the first one is just kind of what I started with, this idea of just explaining to people what a prophecy even is, and why it might be significant, and this idea that that prophecies are, they're not just meant for entertainment, and they're not just meant to frighten people, but that they're actually complicated sources with sophisticated messages that are worth studying. So there's just that level of translation, and then there's trying to get into the medieval mind and to understand what these images and these allusions might have meant to them. Sometimes it can be quite difficult. I mean, so I'm trying to think of an easy example. Something like that. If you saw the eagle, we would say, "Oh, okay. Well, that means the empire, right?" That's kind of an easy example. So people in the late Middle Ages, if they saw an eagle, they understood, "Oh, that means the empire." Or I don't know, if you saw a three-tiered tiara, you know, you would say, "Oh, okay, well that means the Pope." But then there are others that are much, much more difficult. It's very difficult to figure out, well, what did that mean to somebody at the time? What are the possible range of meanings that symbol had for someone in the late Middle Ages? And you have to decode it, which is really always the same things that are the challenges are also what makes it fun. So it's both of those things at once.
That's great. I would like to turn our attention to the last part of your book, or almost the last part, the appendix, because I find it astonishing what you put together here in this book. I think it's really worth mentioning. It's a little extra, I would say. There are descriptions of the manuscripts you used for your research. What information do they contain, and how do they contribute to future research?
Yes, this is, you know, I was trying to think how many manuscripts I've got here. I think something like 50 that I described in detail. So I thought that it would be, for future research, I thought it would be really important to catalog all of the manuscripts, at least that I was aware of, that contained prophetic material. And so, you know, I give the manuscript and the signature, and then I try to give a description of what other material is available in the manuscript, what language it's in, provenance whenever possible, and context, as in, was it clerical? Was it a layperson? You know, kind of whatever we can know about it. And this was really important for me, because one of the things that I was very interested in was this context, you know, what people were reading prophecies and what people were copying prophecies, and what can we know about them. And one thing that maybe is worth mentioning is that I often found that prophecies were in manuscripts with other pious material. And I think that's worth mentioning because, you know, as I've said, they're highly critical of the church, and yet they'll be found in manuscripts alongside sermons or lists of prayers or kind of texts for lay people, you know, explaining the Ten Commandments or this kind of thing. And so there's a suggestion that you could be a pious Christian, a pious, probably German Christian, and that you could also, you could be reading sort of normal pious texts, but then you could also be reading this very radical prophetical material, and that there wasn't a conflict between the two, mm-hmm. that you could do both together, which is very interesting. But I think, you know, just for people going forward, yeah, so they won't have to do this searching that I did, right? I mean, you know, I'm sure, I mean, one thing that started to happen to me at the end is I would joke, I would find a new copy of a prophecy sort of every day. Usually it was a prophecy I already knew about and not just a brand new one, although sometimes it was a brand new one, but I would find another copy. I would look through manuscripts or a list of manuscripts and there's another one, you know, and so I kept having to update and update and update. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm never going to get to the end. But that it, I mean, I think that's significant too for kind of how many are around. So I'm sure, you know, tomorrow we'll find another manuscript that isn't in here. But at least there's a list for people to start from. So if people want to do more research on prophecy, and I certainly hope that they do, they can start with this list and then add to it from there. Mm-hmm.
It's great. It's beautiful. I like the idea that your book is not just, you didn't just finish the book, you opened another chapter of research there, I think. So a place where people could start working on, and that's great.
Yes, I really hope that people do. I really hope that that's what happens, because it, you know, as I said, so many of these sources had never been discovered, had never been read or studied, which means that there is so much still to do and so much still to think about with them.
Mm-hmm. And will you continue working with prophecies?
You know, I in some ways I am. So the book that I'm working on now is, when I was looking for prophecies, what I also found were a lot of writings against prophecy, which makes sense, right? So on the one hand, all of these people are copying and reading prophecies. And on the other hand, there are many sort of authorities saying, oh, this is not a good idea. Prophecy should not be spread among lay people. Prophecy is something that is very sensitive and dangerous, and you have to be very careful with it. And there are all of these rules about who can actually know the future and what they should share with people. And so that's the side I'm looking at now. I'm kind of looking at access to knowledge of the future and the disputing, you know, who should be allowed to have this knowledge of the future? Should lay people be allowed to have it? Should women be allowed to have it? So in a way I'm continuing, but I'm kind of looking at the other side.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are excited about the things to come. would you like to add anything about the book we just talk about, The Empire at the End of Time?
When I tell people about the book, I do think, you know, the number one thing is to understand that the prophecies at the time that they were ubiquitous, that they weren't bizarre outliers and marginal, that they were actually very much kind of ordinary, popular reading material, and that we need to pay attention to things like that, both in the past, but I think still today our visions of the future look different, but we can still study them to find clues to many of the same kinds of things. So how we dissent, how we critique the status quo, and how we collectively form an identity. These are things that we can study in the past, or we can study in prophecies, but then we can also study them in the present.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for this very exciting and interesting insights into the work of your book and the context. It's really exciting. Thank you. Well, we've taken a lot of your time now, Frances. I can't wait for the next projects.
And thank you very much.
And I would like to thank you very much for being on the show tonight, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Goodbye and take care.
Goodbye. Bye.